Connect your application, the system automatically begins charging its own rechargeable batteries. Get the incredible Berkey Solar Charger.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Gretchen Peters, who's written a fascinating book called Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrupting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Gretchen, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you? You are actually a reporter. Who have you worked? You've been working for which one of the, for AP or which one of the major news services?
Most recently, I was the ABC reporter for Pakistan and Afghanistan. I was based there for the last 3 years and commuted to the region essentially since just days after the attacks on New York and Washington in September 2001. So, and previous to that, I covered the region for the Associated Press. So I really worked there on and off for the last decade or a bit more.
All right, fine. Well, first, you have a lot of fascinating insight into the drug problem because, of course, Afghanistan is the really one of the major sources of drugs for the entire world. And since the United States has really been there and been able to control Afghanistan, why the amount of drugs that has been produced there has dramatically increased. And of course, you have some very strong feelings against efforts to spray. But since we haven't really been effective at all, what would you suggest we do to try to stop the drugs? We've been there for almost 8 years now, and they're putting out more drugs than ever before. Are we really trying to stop the growth of drugs there?
Well, during the previous 8 years, under the Bush administration, there really wasn't much effort for quite some time to fight the drugs trade. Initially, the job of fighting counter-narcotics was given to the British government in the Bonn Agreement, the peace agreement, to sort of divvy up the responsibility of rebuilding Afghanistan. And because Afghanistan does produce the world's largest opium crop, and a very, very large cannabis or marijuana crop as well. However, very little of the drugs produced there come to the United States. So the attitude under the previous administration was that it really wasn't our problem. Understandably, our drug counter-narcotics policy has generally focused on trying to keep drugs from reaching U.S. streets. However, what's happening in Afghanistan and also in Pakistan is that the militants, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, other local and regional militant groups that are operating along the borders are increasingly funding themselves through the drugs trade and other criminal activity, timber smuggling, human trafficking, gun running, kidnapping. It's a pattern we've seen around the world with other insurgent groups, everybody from the IRA to the FARC in Colombia, have gotten involved in criminal activity to fund themselves. And it tends to very, very quickly transform insurgent movements into actually much more violent and ruthless organizations than they were initially. And I'm hardly suggesting the Taliban or Al-Qaeda were a lovable bunch to start off with. But what we're seeing, if you look at their ground level, their operations on the ground level, which is what I studied for over the last 4 or 5 years or so, they really behave much more like members of a local mafia or a criminal gang, the same kind of criminal gangs that trouble our inner cities here in the United States. They behave in a very similar fashion among the local population there.
And, of course, you talk really about how the Taliban really seems to be lost a lot of its idealism, more interested in simply making money. Do I interpret your feelings correctly?
Yes and no. I mean, you do interpret it correctly.
Hold that thought for just a minute. We're going to just have a quick break. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Right now we have with us Gretchen Peters, who's a reporter, has covered the area over in Afghanistan there for 3 years. It's been a great deal of information. Talked to a lot of people, certainly talked to a lot of people in the military and the DEA. And her book is really called Seeds of Terror, but it goes into how heroin is bankrupting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And one of the things that points she makes out is that the Taliban, who are over there working in the southern part of Afghanistan, seem to be really more into this at the present time for the money that's there. They're not necessarily growing the crops. They're charging the farmers. They're protecting the convoys. They're protecting or taxing the people who are actually, of course, manufacturing the opium out of the heroin. But you pick up the story. It seems that an awful lot of this is simply just plain criminal activity, more than guided by Islamic fundamentalism. Did I misinterpret that?
No, you've interpreted it correctly. One thing is that we tend to talk about the Taliban as a monolithic organization, when there are really various Talibans. There are various segments of the Taliban on the Afghan side, and there are various factions of it on the Pakistani side. All of them, to some extent or another, are involved in criminal activity to support their cause. All of them cloak themselves in Islam, and I believe they do this in part to win the support of the illiterate masses that live along the border in the border areas, to try and win their support by portraying themselves as holy warriors. But they hardly behave like pious Muslims, from my research. And we surveyed, my research assistants and I surveyed more than 300 people who work in or alongside the drugs trade in areas that the insurgents control or dominate. So then on top of that, we went back and interviewed dozens more officials, other people, farmers, truckers, traders, intelligence agents, law enforcement officials, police, both Western officials and Afghan and Pakistani officials. So we really spent a lot of time talking to as many people as we could about how the system operates, how the money flows through the system, how the different factions of the Taliban interact with each other. And I tend to compare it to the way crime families in the mafia might interact with each other. If you think of movies like The Godfather, where the bosses are all sitting around and they decide that they're going to smuggle drugs and how they're going to divide the money up, there are similar meetings between the various Taliban factions to divide up the spoil.
Hold that thought, please. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Gretchen. Our guest, of course, is Gretchen Peters. We're talking about a book, Seeds of Terror, and goes into the heroin trade in Afghanistan, where she really worked for many years as a reporter. And she's saying that really, of course, the Taliban is increasingly beginning to function more like a criminal syndicate, you know, certainly deciding how they're going to divide up the trade and how much money they're going to be able to take from the farmers and from the various laboratories that are in that area. And how they're going to control the convoys. They actually charge the convoys that carry the drugs, protection money. It sounds very, very similar to the way the mafia works right here in the United States.
It is, and I'd like to make very clear that while I believe that quite a lot of, from our research, I believe that quite a lot of the Taliban commanders have become corrupted by this money and are really just in it now to make a buck, there is definitely a core of true believers, both within the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, who still want to drive Western forces from the region, want to defeat the NATO alliance that's operating there. I believe Al-Qaeda has in no way put away its intention of of trying to launch further attacks against the West and against the United States. In fact, I believe they're involved in criminal activity to save up to fund future attacks. So it's a combination of things. On the ground level, they really operate a lot more like mafiosi, and yet their intention is still that of an insurgent. The intention of the Taliban is still that of an insurgent group. They still intend to push Western forces out of there, and the rising levels of casualty rates for U.S. forces over there are a testimony to that.
Well, of course, you make the point, Sydney, how ruthless the Taliban was in their treatment of women and in their public beheadings and the public chopping off of hands and feet. And certainly this is reprehensible to the average person living in the Western world. But the Saudi Arabians do that. Many of the Gulf countries do that. We never talk about them, and we haven't invaded them. Do the Taliban have a legitimate complaint about their country being occupied? And I mean, certainly wouldn't most countries be objecting if foreign troops came in to, into Los Angeles? Wouldn't we object?
Well, it's interesting. I was just at a conference yesterday about why are we in Afghanistan, and I do think there is, among the American public, there's a growing sense that we don't want to be involved in these complex and expensive wars, either in Afghanistan or Iraq. I do believe that we as a nation owe it both to the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan and also to our own nation's security to try and stabilize that region. I think that the strategy towards Afghanistan has been, by and large, misguided up until now. I'm cautiously optimistic that at least the military is trying to implement stability operations there that will bring better governance to the people of the border areas. And I do think that is a way forward that will help. That's an exit strategy for the United States. It will leave these communities more stable so they can govern themselves the way that they want to. I don't believe we rushed to impose democracy on the country, and then that has in some ways backfired.
Well,
but I do believe if we give them the fundamentals to build a stable society for themselves, at this point, I really do believe that is our responsibility. You have to go back through history, and I've done that in the book, Seeds of Terror. The United States helped create these groups, really, in the 1980s by funding the Mujahideen as part of the Soviet resistance in Afghanistan, which most historians believe is the reason led to the eventual downfall of the Soviet Union. So, in effect, we created and armed and funded the Islamic extremists that later turned into the Taliban and Al Qaeda.
Well,
so we created this mess, and I think we have a responsibility as a nation to help these countries get out of it. And I also believe it will make our nation safer.
Well, do you think that perhaps the fact that we're over there? I mean, certainly. Fighting over there, and don't you think that perhaps many of the people in the Islamic world resent America, and many people are actually recruited into the terrorist activity because we are they look upon it as occupiers of their land.
Absolutely. There's a tremendous resentment, and the whole existence of Al-Qaeda is due to the presence. One of their main complaints is the presence of thousands of U.S. troops in the Saudi Peninsula, which they correctly interpret as being there to protect our oil supply. I think we as a nation need to do more relieve our dependence on Middle Eastern oil, on oil in general, for that matter. But there's a tremendous amount of resentment across the Muslim world, and I've lived not only in Pakistan and Afghanistan, but also in Egypt over the last 6-5 years, and you're absolutely right about that. I still think that if we as a nation, we as people adopt a more moral strategy towards the region instead of propping up dictators and military dictatorships and regimes that allow no freedoms, we will continue to feel that resentment. But I do think the United States can be a force for good in that region.
Well, but we've been there for 8 years, and I mean, would we spend 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? I mean,
that's a very good question. How long will this take? And how much, possibly more importantly, how much will it cost us in blood and treasure? These are very, very difficult questions, and at this point, the situation is such a mess in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, that it's particularly Pakistan, that it's very hard to see a good way out of this. I still stick by my argument that the fastest, most economical, and most moral exit strategy for us in the region is to support community-level development that will allow the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan to create the kind of society that they want, that is not... I have lived and worked in that region for a long time, and I can tell you that the people in the border areas are simple people. They're conservative. They're religious. I compare it often to our Bible Belt here in the United States. They're conservative and religious, but they're not fanatics any more than people are here. They're not bent on destroying the United States or attacking our nation or flying planes into skyscrapers. There's a very, very small band of extremist terrorist groups that want to attack us. We need to help the people of those border areas drive them out drive them out of their communities and arrest them, get rid of them, basically. And once we do that, that region will be able to rebuild on its own, and I don't think we have to stay there forever.
I certainly hope not. Now, one of the interesting things you make in your book is you point out that we've been there 8 years now, going on 9 years in Afghanistan, and there are more drugs than ever before. And, of course, you said that the U.S. policy was to want to spray. You felt that spraying was wrong because it was going to, of course, create an artificial shortage, and that would drive up the prices, and they'd make more money. But certainly, if you don't try to get rid of the crop, I mean, certainly America is in charge of that country. You even talk about going out on, certainly with groups of contract agents from some of the mercenaries along with the Afghan police, and driving past field after field after field of crops. Why didn't they simply burn them down? Or why didn't they come in and spray them? Or should we just allow them more drugs because that'll lower the price and they won't make so much money?
Well, what we've seen over the last few years is the poppy crop has actually gotten so large that the price, the farm gate price of opium is dropping. And in some areas, the farmers are choosing to grow other crops because relatively it has become less lucrative for them to grow opium, and there's so much danger involved in it. So I do think at this point, a large-scale, wide-scale spraying campaign would not only alienate tens of thousands of farmers and people in these rural areas who we really need to get on our side, but it will also drive up the price of opium back up and make it more lucrative to purchase opium. As well, the Taliban and the drug traders already have these absolutely enormous stockpiles of opium. It's believed that the stockpiles of opium are more than 8,000 tons. Just a few weeks ago, NATO forces in the town of Marja in southern Afghanistan overran a Taliban stronghold, a Taliban hideout, and they found 92 tons of opiates there. 92 tons, can you imagine? That is an immense amount of drugs. If you remember the movie The French Connection, which was about one of the biggest heroin stings in U.S. history, that was 16 kilos of drugs. 92 tons is the second largest drug seizure in world history that was just made at a Taliban stronghold. I believe we need to go after these hideouts where they're storing the drugs. We need to go after the drug convoys that are, we need to make them targets of our military campaign, also the drug labs. But I don't think there is as much to gain by going after the farmers and the farm level. That's where the opium is actually lowest in value. It becomes much more valuable once it's reached the drug refineries and is refined into morphine base or refined into heroin. It goes up in value by many times over. It really depends on the area, but as much as 4 or 5 or 10 times in value. At that point, it's the traffickers and the extremist groups that are profiting, not the farmers. Those are the people we need to hit in their pocketbooks, not the farmers.
Well, then why don't we have satellites? Certainly those satellites can spy on everything in this country and certainly in Afghanistan day and night. Why don't we go after the labs? Why don't we go after the big guys?
Good
you
question.
Mentioned many people are making fabulous sums of money over there, very wealthy landowners in Afghanistan growing that. Why don't we go after those convoys? You mean we can't tell them when there's a convoy on a road?
We can. I do
hold
believe
that. Hold that just a moment. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a moment. Well, forgive me for interrupting you, but the computer tells me that we have to take a quick break, so go right ahead, please. And of course, these are issues that, I mean, we've been there for 9 years. I mean, we can't figure out where the drug labs are. We can't figure out who the major drug producers are.
I think we know exactly who the major drug producers are. I think the government has plenty of intelligence on this. I'm not precisely sure why it's taken so long to get the NATO alliance on board with us, but there does seem to be, at least at the Pentagon, an understanding that they now need to cut off, they need to attack this end of the drug trade. They need to stop going after the farmers, and they need to start going after the traffickers. There's actually relatively few of them. And another important aspect of this is going after the money launderers. The drug side, the physical drug side of the drug trade anywhere in the world is one side of it, but the whole point of smuggling drugs is to make money. It's incredibly lucrative to make lots and lots of money. We've done very, very little as a nation, and the NATO alliance fighting in Afghanistan has done very, very little to try and disrupt the flow of drug money. That actually extends well beyond Afghanistan. In fact, probably the most lucrative end of it, where it supports the Taliban and the other extremist groups, is actually in Pakistan and Dubai. I think a lot more work needs to be done on that end of things to try and disrupt the funds that are bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Well, why haven't we done it? I mean, that would be the obvious question
to
ask.
That's why I wrote the book. That's why I wrote the book. It's an excellent question. I was sitting there, living there, watching this happen, watching this immense economy all around me that nobody was doing anything about. And I finally decided it was time to start clanging the bell and say, why aren't we doing this? I do think people are paying attention. I've given briefings now at the Pentagon. I'm meeting with Ambassador Richard Holbrooke's staff and the ambassador himself next week. I'm supposed to meet with the DEA in the near future. I do believe people are paying attention to this. I do believe that strategy is shifting. However, why haven't we done it before? I don't know. I don't know, and it's one of the reasons we're in the mess that we're in now out there.
I agree with you totally, and certainly I realize that you wrote this book to try to focus attention on a very real problem that is not being addressed, and it certainly looks very bad for the United States, where after we've, 8 years or so, something like that, we're just now beginning to get around to thinking that maybe we ought to be doing something, and it takes somebody, a reporter, who writes a book to focus attention on the most logical thing. If you want to stop, of course, the profit in the drug trade, why, you would go after the money, you'd go after the convoys, you'd go after the producers, you would go after the major growers. And you commented in your book that there's some very large landowners there, not the little guy that, you know, just got a little plot of land and is trying to keep his wife and family alive, but the major landowners who are making fabulous fortunes growing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's the majority of the people who work the farms are small farmers and poor sharecroppers, and they really do not benefit. In fact, I would say they are as victimized by the drug trade in Afghanistan as anybody. Many of them also addicted to the crop because these areas where the poppy is grown are so dangerous that all of the health clinics have shut down, aid groups have pulled out, and so...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Gretchen writes in her book, and the book is called The Seeds of Terror, and it's a very, very good read. She talks about the plight of the Afghan. The average farmer there, he's making a dollar a day, and he's got to be, I mean, what is it, a dollar a day for a family or a dollar a day for a person?
It really depends on the area, but it's often a dollar a day per person or even less. They really have a very, very difficult situation, and one of the strategies that's going to have to be implemented is going to in addition to going after the traffickers and the insurgents and extremist groups that are protecting the trade, we're also going to have to do more aid work to offer these communities alternative livelihoods. There have been alternative livelihood projects in Afghanistan. I think so far they have been, by and large, an abject failure because we failed to provide security in these communities. Now there's this new deployment of 17,000 more troops to the area. I think that's a good start, and that will help build stability and security in some of the worst and most dangerous areas. But it is going to be very, very difficult. I'm not suggesting this is going to be easy. And unfortunately, at a time when our nation can ill afford it, I think it's going to be quite expensive as well. And our allies in Europe have so far really refused to pony up the money that to help contribute to paying for this.
In fact, most of the drug trade was really in the British zone, wasn't it? The British were responsible, and they just didn't do anything about the massive drug trade there?
Well, they did quite a bit, in fact, but a lot of the British effort focused really on stopping the flow of drugs to Britain, as opposed to stopping it in general. And another issue that we haven't touched on yet, Stan, and that's very, very important, is that as much as the Taliban and the insurgents along the border are involved in the drug trade and profiting off it, there are immense amounts of corruption within the Afghan government and the police and the border police and the border guards. So a very big problem both for the British and the Americans are facing, as well as American officials get more deeply involved in trying to fight this, is not just that we're fighting an insurgency that is funded by the drug trade, but we have a very difficult time finding reliable partners to work with, because government officials who are involved in it, there's this perverse incentive for Afghanistan to become more stable, because as it becomes more stable, they would then lose these criminal profits that they're making. And the profits are absolutely immense. I mean, I heard tales of district police commanders who were paying $40,000 a month just to the higher-ups just to hold on to their job. So you can imagine the amount of money they were making in bribes and protection fees, just immense amounts of money that are passing through. It's believed that the drug trade in Afghanistan in total earns about $4 billion. And none of that money goes towards stabilizing Afghanistan. It's all just destabilizing the country, making it more and more dangerous, and making it more and more expensive for us as a nation to fight it.
Well, now, what about Karzai, who is, of course, the gentleman who is supposedly the ruler, the president, duly elected? Does he really have the support of the people? Or is he, as we have been told, really an American puppet who used to work for UNICAL, for an American oil company?
Well, he was widely considered to be an American puppet for many years. He's allegations that he has protected members of his tribe, which is from southern Afghanistan, and members of his own family who are involved in the drug trade. In particular, there are widespread allegations, and I was shown and write in the book about intelligence reports implicating his own brother, half-brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, in the drugs trade. Over time, American officials have become very, very disillusioned by President Karzai, and I would say his relationship with the Obama administration in particular is very, very frosty. We'll see how much public support he has in August, when Afghanistan is due to hold elections again. President Karzai is running. Some of his running mates have been tied to illegal activity. So we'll see next month.
Well, do you think
the Afghans won him back?
Do you think the elections will be as honest as they are in Chicago?
I think they'll be about as honest as they are in Chicago or maybe Iran.
Right. Well, these are the I hate to joke about that sort of thing, but you can see the frustration of the people. And as Chris Gretchen described, some of the farmers she met, they're making a dollar a day. How do you survive on something like that? Or maybe you got making $2 or $3 a day if they're really doing well and they got a wife and a couple of children. And it's a totally frustrating situation for the people there, but it's totally frustrating when you try to figure out what to do. We're going to be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest is Gretchen Peters. Her book is Seeds of Terror. And of course this book is written to try to focus the attention of people on the tragedy of what's going on in Afghanistan today. Really, as far as the drug trade is concerned, because of course this is the major the source of income for the country. Now, what about we hear people talk about the fact that one reason we went in there, whether this is true or not, I'd like your thoughts, but they want to build an oil pipeline, certainly from Central Asia, through Afghanistan, so they need to go back there, down through Pakistan, then into the Indian Ocean. Is there really any force there to try to build such a pipeline, and could it be put in with all the lawlessness that exists?
Well, there are these massive reserves of natural gas underneath the Central Asian nation of Turkmenistan, which is just to the north of Afghanistan. And there are two ways that that natural gas could be piped to the wider world. There are several ways. A pipeline could go through down through Iran, which is something the United States does not want to see happen. It could go up through Russia, which again is something the United States does not want to see happen. And there have been efforts, as you mentioned earlier, President Karzai himself used to work for the American oil firm Unocal, which was trying to build a pipeline through Afghanistan and down through Pakistan. Of course, there's always a lot of allegations that this is all about oil, just like the Iraq war. I think we have to acknowledge that America's energy needs play a tremendous role in our foreign policy, and I think we as a nation owe it to ourselves to do something about that and try to wean ourselves off of the forms of fossil fuels. But you're certainly right. There's certainly a link to that. I don't think there's any talk of building a pipeline now through Afghanistan. It's just too war torn. But at the same time, those gas fields in Central Asia could in some ways be a stabilizing force eventually for that region, because they will bring tremendous amounts of money and wealth to the region.
All right, fine. Well, of course, it really sounds like one of the major problems over there is just the abject poverty. And, of course, you mentioned earlier the efforts to try to give the farmers there an alternative to growing heroin. In other words, other crops that they could grow where they'd be able to generate an income. You've got people who are living on the farms. They need an income. And apparently USAID had gone over there. And I'm told just a moment, we'll get to that in just a second. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Again, our guest is Gretchen Peters, her book Seeds of Terror. And before we go on, Gretchen, would you like to get your website out or tell people how they can get copies of your book?
Yes, well, the book's available at major bookstores. It's available on Amazon. You can also buy it. There are links on my website, which is gretchenpeters.org. That's .org. And I'm trying to update information that I hear about the region and post things I think are relevant in the news to my blog that's on the website a couple times a week. Right now I've been doing a lot of book touring and speaking at conferences, so I put my schedule up there as well. So I'm trying to have the website be a living, breathing organism that goes along with the book and keeps people updated to a situation that's very, very interesting and changing very quickly. So, yes, I hope readers, people who are interested will go and check out the website, send me a message, post a message if you want, and keep the conversation going about this, what I consider to be a very, very important topic and possibly a real security threat to our nation if these groups become more and more wealthy. They swell in power.
Well, now, of course, having lived in that part of the world for many years, do you think that Osama bin Laden's really still alive, or do you think that they're keeping the myth of Osama bin Laden alive, sort of rally the people behind either the Bush or the Obama administration?
Well, just last week, there was an audio recording released from Osama bin Laden that referred to recent news events, so it would appear that he is still alive. I don't think he has... He clearly doesn't have much freedom of movement. We haven't seen a video of him since the 2004 election, just days before the 2004 election. It's not, most Al-Qaeda watchers believe that he does not have day-to-day command over the running of the operation, of his organization. But I do believe that he's still alive and living somewhere in Pakistan.
Can we really trust the intelligence agencies to always tell us the truth?
Which ones?
The only way we know this is Osama bin Laden is because the CIA tells us it's Osama bin Laden, but do we really know that's accurate, or do we just have to
Before, I mean, I listened to the recording. It does sound like his voice. I mean, I don't have sensors to say whether it's... But these messages get posted on Islamist websites linked to Al-Qaeda, and in this case a tape was dropped off at the Al Jazeera office in Islamabad, as they have done before, and I personally believe he's still out there.
All right, fine.
Whether we can trust our intelligence services is another thing, but I think that he is still out there.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question for Gretchen. But before we came to the last break, I was asking about the alternative for the average farmer there who really grows heroin because it's the only thing that'll really give him enough money to feed his family. Why hasn't the United States gone in there and tried to convince the farmers to grow more productive crops that would not, of course, feed the heroin addiction of Europe and certainly here in the United States?
Well, there are a lot of reasons that farmers will grow opium, and it's not always by choice. In some areas, they have been threatened by the Taliban or other criminal gangs that operate in their area of dire consequences if they don't grow opium. Another real issue is that they don't have buyers for other crops. Afghanistan's infrastructure has been devastated by years of war. If you've ever ridden down one of Afghanistan's spine-crushing highways, you'll understand why a farmer who grows oranges or grapes or apples can't get them to market, because they would be completely bruised and destroyed by the time they get there. As well, the fact that aid groups and other businesses have left these very dangerous areas controlled by the insurgents means there's no microcredit. One of the things that happens with the drug traffickers is that they send poppy agents. They have agents that come in the fall and pre-purchase the farmers' crops, which gives them the money to get their very poor families through the winter months. And what happens then is that they charge them these, it's a predatory loan, it's essentially a predatory farm support system, a predatory loan network that traps the farmers in debt. So the next year they have to grow more poppy to pay off these same agents. And it traps them in this cycle of poppy debt that many of them have been trapped in for years and years and can't get out of. And there are appalling stories of farmers having to sell their daughters to these merchants to try and pay off their debts or sell off their land. One of the things that I support or that I argue for in the book is that we should be subsidizing legal crops. We should be going in and offering to buy their oranges or their grapes or their wheat in the fall and trying to offer some of the same microcredit programs that used to exist in the area. Afghanistan has not been a drug-producing nation for a long time. This really began when the war began in 1979. Prior to that, it was a food-exporting nation, and it can be again. There's no reason why it can't be again, but very little has been done to create a farm support system for Afghans to grow legal crops. And I think some of our programs there have been very, very expensive failures, and really a relatively simple system would work. That would, in effect, duplicate what the Taliban are doing, offering to buy the farmers' crops in the fall rather than and getting in ahead of the Taliban. However, that's not going to work if there isn't security. So it is going to depend on these troops going out and providing protection and security in these communities so they can go about their normal life.
Well, it's really such a tragic situation. Afghanistan's been at war for 29, almost 30 years, and we're dating back to 1979. And, of course, this was really all about, of course, we were over there, and Zbigniew Brzezinski even bragged later how he had precipitated the Afghan war. And, of course, then he's justified that by saying that, well, but it was really worth it, to topple communism. And so, I mean, they got involved in this long war that they could never win, and that's why communism fell. But could that lead to the downfall of our own country financially? How long can we continue running massive deficits before pretty soon other countries in the world stop financing our foreign wars? Let's go to Rob, who's calling in Long Island. Before I do you have any thoughts on that? I'm very worried about how long we can continue our more or less an imperialistic policy of trying to solve the problems of the rest of the world when we can't even pay our own debts here in America.
Well, I absolutely agree, and that's why I argue that if we implement a counterinsurgency strategy to help the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan and these border areas that are infested with these Taliban and other regional extremists. They don't like them. They don't support them. The people in those areas, if you read the news stories that are pouring out of the Swat Valley in Pakistan or the tribal areas or southern Afghanistan, the people want to push them out of these areas. If we help them do that, provide the space to build a basic community building and community stability, from there they can take it on their own. I don't think anybody wants to be out there, but the idea that we will continue to try and fight them and to continue to knock them off one by one with predator strikes, that to me is a much more expensive and unsustainable option.
Thank you. Let's go to Rob, who's calling us from Long Island. Hi, Rob. Do you have a question?
I do. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
Hey. I'm wondering if you guys have read the book by Michael Rupert, Crossing the Rubicon. And in it, he posits that the reason we actually went to war in Afghanistan was because the Taliban had shut down the poppy production, and because the CIA was laundering all of that drug money through the stock market, it created the stock market crash in 2000.
All right. Well, let's get our guest thoughts on that. And thanks very much for calling. Have you any thoughts at all about the statement that's been made that when the Taliban was in charge over there, that they had pretty well shut down the poppy production, and only after America came in and chased the Taliban out, did the drug production return? Is there any truth to that?
Well, yes and no. The Taliban did ban poppy cultivation for 1 year. In the year 2000, they banned farmers from growing poppy. However, they didn't actually stop the trade in poppy. I haven't read the book, so I can't comment specifically on the author's argument. However, I would certainly agree that a lot of Afghan drug money is laundered through Western banking institutions. I've not seen any evidence personally that the CIA is involved. However, I haven't read this this book.
The book is entitled Crossing the Rubicon. It's by Michael Rupert, who incidentally he's been so intimidated, he's living, after they tried to poison him, he's living in hiding in Canada today. I've known Michael for many years. So he's actually living in hiding after writing the book, so I don't know what that means.
Right. Well, what I can say is that the Taliban did ban farmers from growing poppy. However, as I discussed in Seeds of Terror, they didn't stop poppy from being opium from being trafficked from the region. They continued to tax it. The labs continued to operate, and in fact, when they banned poppy, there were similar to today. There were just these enormous stockpiles of opium that had built up around Afghanistan because the poppy crop was so huge, and the Taliban. It was essentially, by my analysis of it, I often compare it to an insider trading deal where senior Taliban leaders bought up huge amounts of poppy, then they banned farmers from growing more, and the price of poppy went through the roof, and they all made millions. So I think there was still a lot of money from Afghanistan's drug trade that was still filtering out of that country that simply wasn't, poppy simply wasn't being grown that year. But it's certainly true that the poppy fields were carpeting the Afghan countryside the year after the invasion, and that U.S. forces initially did nothing to stop it. And in fact, there's very clear evidence, and again, this is something I discuss in the book, that members of the CIA worked very closely with warlords who were also believed to be deeply involved in the drug trade, and so I think that's an issue that very much needs to be investigated. Similar to the Iran-Contra scandal, there's very, very clear evidence that the CIA was in bed with powerful warlords who have long-standing connections to the drug trade, and it's very clear from many of the intelligence documents that I found and declassified government records that I went across, that the U.S. government was very aware of their drug trading activities.
Well, that is a little distressing. Well, let's go, of course, to Annette, who's calling from West Virginia. Hi, Annette. How are you doing? Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. Good evening. My first question and information was really covered by the previous caller, because I knew that Afghanistan had significantly decreased the poppy production, but when we started the war, it just exploded. And I'm aware, and really you are too, sir, that you know the global plan.
Right, but do you have a question, though, for our guest?
Well, the question is, does the young lady, I had a concussion, so my memory isn't too good.
Her name is Gretchen Peters, but that's all right. Go ahead.
Ms. Peters, the global plan was to go in and take over the energy resources of that area, and that's why we're there. And Benazir Bhutto knew that bin Laden had been killed. She said he was dead, and she was assassinated.
Okay, do you have a question, Annette? Because I think our guest has already addressed that issue. Do you have a question for us?
Well, the question is that she seems to come out with information after questions are raised.
Well, she writes a very, very good book, and let me recommend her book to you. It's called Seeds of Terror. And, of course, we don't have time to go into all the aspects of it, but she covers a great deal in the book, and I think she's addressed the issue. Certainly, the problem and the solution, well, we just have to wait and see. Hey, thank you so very much for calling, Annette. And certainly, our guest, of course, is Gretchen Peters. Are you going to be able to stay here in the United States for a time, or are you going to have to go back overseas?
No, I'm living in the United States now. I think once you write a book about drug dealers and terrorists, a good idea to move away from that region.
All right. Is your husband going to be able to stay here with you? Is he off?
Yes. The whole family's come back.
All right, fine. He was a photographer, wasn't he, for one of the news services?
Yes, he's a photographer for Getty Images. He, in fact, took some of the last pictures of Benazir Bhutto when he was at the rally where she was assassinated and was standing in front of her car when the suicide bomber and assassin shot her and then blew himself up.
Well, I'm certainly glad that he got back and that you got back here safely, because it's a violent part of the world. You know, I haven't decided whether we live in the real world or they live in the real world and we live in a make-believe world here. But so much of the world is so violent and there's so many terrible things that are happening, and the average individual here in the United States, where we live in the truly a utopian world, cannot imagine what it would be like to live in the abject poverty that almost half the world lives in.
Absolutely. I think Americans don't realize how lucky we are, and I think that but I'd like to say that for most of the time that I lived in Pakistan and Afghanistan, many people ask me how I was able to research this book. I think the people of those nations are wonderful people and friendly and warm, and I was welcomed. I lived there with my husband and my two children. We were warmly welcomed by the communities of both countries. I didn't travel the border areas extensively with my two young children, but I did travel around both countries with my family, traveled to both countries, and lived in Pakistan for years. And I think one of the mistakes that our government has made for decades has been to continue to prop up really corrupt and ineffectual leaders in both of those countries and in other parts of the Muslim world, and we are seeing the blowback from that now. I do think we as a nation would serve ourselves better to support the people of those countries in their quest to find better governance.
Well, of course, we saw what happened in Iran, where we overthrew the democratically elected government of Mossadegh, put in the Shah, then we overthrew the Shah and brought in the Ayatollahs, and maybe we ought to stay
out of it.
Well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Well, I mean, I guess that's my final thought, really, is that working at a community level, going in and helping the people create a better life for themselves, I do believe we're seeing the three protests that are going on in Iran. I was are a sign of this. In Afghanistan, we've seen women on the streets protesting the recent law that they attempted to pass that would have legalized marital rape and other forms of abuse of women. I lived through the lawyers' protests in Pakistan. These are people of the Muslim world coming out on the streets wanting justice, wanting better governance, fairer governance, and human rights. And I believe that those are universal demands that people have. I believe that to what extent we can support those at a community level, grassroots level, we as a nation will do ourselves a service as well. It's not just the morally right thing to do, it will make us safer.
Well, you know, people are the same really all over the world. Most people are wonderful. Did you speak the language over there? Did you speak Arabic? Or?
No, I don't speak Arabic. The language is primarily spoken in Pakistan and Afghanistan are Urdu, Pashto, and Dari. I can speak a few words of each, but I don't speak them well. Pakistan was a former British colony, so a lot of people speak English as well. I speak Spanish, but my language skills are not terrific in that part of the world. I wish they were better.
Well, that's certainly, we are very, very fortunate to speak English, because really, of course, English is almost a universal language today, English and French. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us and for your courage in writing the book. I think it's an important contribution to understanding what is really going on. I do hope, of course, that you can have an effect on Mr. Holbrooke, and that he and the current establishment in Washington, D.C., will decide to do something to try to really correct the failed policies of the Bush administration. Anyway, God bless you, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope your listeners enjoyed Gretchen Peters. I think that she's done a great job talking on this. Somebody wanted to know about depleted uranium, but I really don't think that Gretchen be in a position to comment on the question of depleted uranium. We have to sort of keep the questions to the issue at hand, because many times our listeners really don't understand everything that the people who listen to Radio Liberty understand. After all, you're getting a much different approach to the problems that exist throughout the world. But Gretchen's done a great job. It's a very readable book, and we certainly would commend Seeds of Treason to you. Well, this is Dr. Stan. The book, again, is Seeds of Terror, and we do hope that you enjoyed our interview with Gretchen Peters, a very nice lady who's really very, very courageous to write about this very, very real problem. And I thought it was so interesting that that she commented that going through the records, she was well aware of the fact that people in government were aware of the fact that people in the CIA were working with some of the warlords who were involved in and growing of large quantities of heroin. So nothing as it appears to be. And of course, our plea to you is get educated on this subject. Certainly we have a four-tape set. Is there really a war on drugs? And of course, somebody had called in and pointed out that when the Taliban was in charge, they shut down the drug traffic. And Gretchen pointed out, when the Americans came in, the year after the Americans came in, why, of course, the production of heroin was going full speed. Why would that be? Why would the Taliban, the wicked Taliban, shut down the drug trade, and the courageous Americans coming to liberate the people would allow the trade to resume? And we didn't want to, of course, push that issue, but I hope it's a question all of you will ask. Let me suggest, of course, we have a four-tape set. It's entitled The Men We Left Behind, including my interviews with a woman, of course, who wrote the book Kiss the Boys Goodbye, Kiss the Boy Goodbye, Monica Jensen Stevenson, where she talks about, of course, the real reason why we fought almost a 10-year war in Vietnam was to allow the CIA to continue the drug trade. That was her supposition. Fascinating interview. Of course, the book was actively suppressed here in the United States, and when Monica actually took the rights of the book to Canada and had it published there, they just accidentally shredded 5,000 copies. That's covered in our second four tape set on this issue. The first one is The Men We Left Behind. The second one is One Man Returned, my second interview with Monica, where she tells how they just accidentally shredded a 5,000 copies of her book that talked about the CIA and drugs. We have another book, of course, called Into the Buzzsaw, where you'll have an interview with Gary Webb, who wrote about the CIA and the drug trafficking. And, of course, Gary, as you remember, shot himself in the head twice to commit suicide, and he shot himself twice to make sure he was dead. So we do have the four-tape set, Is There Really a War on Drugs? We have the book Into the Buzzsaw, which is essays with people who tried to bring the truth out to the American people, and, of course, what happened to them. One of the essays is with Monica Jensen Stevenson. We have the four-tape set, one of the interviews with Monica Jensen Stevenson, where she talks about her book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye and the CIA Involvement in Drugs. The second four-tape set, One Man Returned, going in once again, the CIA involvement in drugs. We can't let the American people know that. After all, we have a war on drugs, but we seem to be getting more drugs. We have a war on terror, but we get more terrorism. We have a war on cancer, but we get more cancer. Why is that happening? Well, we do hope you'll get my book on the Brotherhood of Darkness, which explains the real common motivation behind everything going on. You get the DVD, or you can get the book. My DVD on the Forbidden Secret and the syllabus that goes with that. My talk on the financial Armageddon and the syllabus that goes with that. And you must understand what's going on today, because most people are going to lose everything they have before this financial crisis is over. It's not getting better, as they're trying to tell you. It's getting worse. We have a four-tape set called The Financial Armageddon, interviews with with experts is fairly up-to-date interviews. We think it's important. That's the Financial Armageddon. We have my talk on the financial tsunami, a talk I gave 3 or 4 years ago, but it explained everything that was going to happen, and it's all coming to pass. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com, that's RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen to our internet programs 4 hours a day, and then please pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and our protection.